Dr. William Luther Pierce, 2002. The Big Lie.
Hello. In the 8 months since the September 11th attack, I've had probably 50 interviews with people from the mass media. A standard question they nearly always ask me is, how have I responded to the attack? Part of my answer to that question is that I have tried to use the reaction of the government and the mass media to the attack to show that the politicians and the media lie shamelessly and outrageously to the American people about matters of vital importance. That is, everyone who pays attention to what is happening in the world, which is to say, everyone except the lemmings, understands that the attack was a retaliation for the U.S. government's arming and financing Israel's aggression in the Middle East. That is crystal clear. And yet, everyone in the government and everyone in the mass media has denied it since September 11th. Their standard response to the question, why were we attacked, is that there is no good reason for it. We were attacked only because Osama bin Laden hates our freedom. The attack certainly had nothing at all to do with American policy in the Middle East or with Israel. We would have been attacked even if we never had supported Israel, they say. Not only did Mr. Bush and Mr. Cheney and Mr. Ashcroft and everyone else in the government and every media spokesman repeat this lie over and over again, but they tried hard to avoid the question. It became politically incorrect even to ask why we were attacked. And it was all very obvious, at least to the perceptive portion of the population. Usually, the politicians and the media bosses have time to prepare their lies more carefully and rehearse them. But September 11th caught them by surprise, and their lies and their attempts at misdirection were clumsy and transparent. Good enough for the lemmings, but certainly not good enough to fool anyone able to observe and think for himself. Usually, a clever liar will leave enough ambiguity in his lies so that it's difficult for anyone to say with absolute certainty that he's lying. One can be pretty sure that he's lying, but there's usually a little doubt. Maybe it's not really a deliberate lie. Maybe it's just a difference of opinion, a difference in interpretation. But in the case of September 11th, with the government and the media both claiming that the attack had nothing to do with the government's support for Jewish policy in the Middle East, there is no room for ambiguity. They're lying. And the things they're lying about are not trivial, not the sort of inconsequential lies that politicians always tell to get reelected. The lies about American foreign policy and its consequences are important lies. Big lies, lies that impact heavily on America's security and survival. And so, nearly every time a reporter asks me about September 11th, I use the opportunity to point out that George Bush is a liar, a conscious, deliberate, bald-faced, shameless liar. Of course, he's much worse than merely a liar. He's also a traitor. He has cynically and deliberately violated his oath of office and betrayed America, betrayed our people. And I use the September 11th attack to illustrate that too. If George Bush claimed that the September 11th attack was not a response to the government's pro-Israel policy simply because he didn't want to be blamed for having a bad policy that got more than 3,000 Americans killed, then he could have set about changing that policy after September 11th. He could at least have opened the policy up for discussion. He could have blamed the policy on Bill Clinton. He could have said that it was just one of many bad policies left over from the Clinton era that he hadn't gotten around to changing yet. But there was no discussion, and there were no changes. Discussion of whether the United States should pursue America's interests in the Middle East or Israel's interests simply is not permitted. It is a taboo subject, and it is clear enough why it is a taboo subject. When Osama bin Laden attacked the United States on September 11th, he did much more than send us a message that Muslims are not happy about what the Jews, with the aid and support of the U.S. government, are doing to the Palestinians. He forced the American people, at least the 2 or 3% of the American people able to think for themselves, to pay attention to what their government is doing. He forced the whole subject of U.S. policy in the Middle East into the open, the subject of America's interests versus Jewish interests, of Jewish media control and its influence on governmental policy. He broke the taboo. He exposed the treason. In the long run, that may more than compensate for the 3,000 American lives that were lost. And of course, the fact that his attack opened up for debate the subject of American interests versus Jewish interests, the fact that he exposed the treason, is the real reason that George Bush hates him enough to start a war to punish him. To be sure, Bush is more popular than ever with the Lemmings. They have accepted without question his explanation that we were attacked only because Osama bin Laden hates our freedom. It is only the thinking minority who have seen his nakedness, and they don't have enough votes to make a difference. Nevertheless, it is the thinking minority, not the Lemmings, that one day will judge him and condemn him and hang him. And behind that smirk of his, he knows it. Let's get back to the subject of lying to the American people. It's something that is continuous and massive. But as I said earlier, there's usually a certain degree of ambiguity to it, so that it's difficult to prove that any particular lie is a conscious and deliberate lie. And so, when I encounter a lie that's easy to prove is a lie, I like to use it as an example. There's a Jewish outfit that calls itself FLAME, F-L-A-M-E. That's an acronym for Facts and Logic About the Middle East. FLAME buys full-page ads in various print media, and instead of facts and logic, publishes pretty outrageous lies about the Middle East that are proved fairly easily to be lies. I have one of FLAME's full-page ads in front of me now. It's titled Arabian Fables, and the copy I have appeared in the February 11th issue of U.S. News and World Report. According to the FLAME ad, quote, the fundamental myth, unquote, about the Middle East is that there are any such people as Palestinians. Before 1948, according to FLAME, the Palestinians were Jews, and now they are Israelis. But in 1948, Arabs who wanted to take the Jews' land away from them began calling themselves Palestinians. The clear implication of the FLAME ad is that the people of Palestine always were Jews, and that the people calling themselves Palestinians today are Arab interlopers. That is the opposite of the truth. Actually, there are hundreds of books available that were written before the current conflict between Jews and Palestinians began that provide demographic data on Palestine. Just before the First World War in 1914, Palestine was a part of the Ottoman Empire. In that year, the Turkish government took an official census. Of a total population of 689,000, just 84,660, or 12.3%, were Jews, and many of those were recent immigrants who had come to Palestine as part of the Zionist movement. During the First World War, Britain took Palestine away from Turkey and after the war permitted large numbers of additional Jews to immigrate. According to the official British census of 1931, the Jewish population of Palestine had risen to 16.9%. That's 174,606 Jews in a total population of 1,033,314. The influx of Jews into Palestine during the 1920s and 1930s was a source of continual provocation to the native Palestinians, and there were a number of riots and other disorders. Jewish pressure on the British government, however, prevented the British from making any permanent or effective halt to the immigration of Jews into Palestine. After the Second World War, shortly before the United Nations partition of Palestine into separate Jewish and non-Jewish areas, Jews still made up less than one-third of the population of Palestine. The 1946 British census counted 608,000 Jews out of a total population of 1,845,000. The great majority of these Jews were recent immigrants, whereas nearly all of the Arabs were natives who had roots in Palestine going back many generations. What the Jews had that the Palestinians didn't have, however, was a very substantial degree of control of the governments of the United States and the United Kingdom, and these two countries exerted a decisive influence on the policies of the United Nations. The result of this influence was the partition of Palestine in 1948 into separate Jewish and non-Jewish areas, with the one-third of the population that was Jewish being awarded two-thirds of the land, including the most valuable areas. The Jews immediately set about ethnically cleansing their areas, carrying out a number of horrifying massacres of non-Jewish Palestinians and terrorizing tens of thousands of others into fleeing from their homes, which immediately were seized and occupied by the Jews. In a series of wars since 1948, the Jews, backed by the United States, seized even more Palestinian land. The Palestinians who were driven from their land, the real Palestinians, whose parents and grandparents and great-grandparents had owned the land, were forced into crowded and dirty refugee camps where they still live. And whenever one of these dispossessed Palestinians strikes back at the Jews who stole his country from him, everyone in the Bush government, from the chief liar on down, and everyone in the controlled media here denounces the Palestinian as a terrorist. And all of the Sally Soccer Moms and Joe Sixpacks nod in agreement. I'll tell you about one of these Palestinian terrorists you've certainly heard mentioned by the media if you pay any attention at all to what's happening in the world. He's called Abu Nidal, the most feared Palestinian terrorist of them all. The name the man called Abu Nidal was born with is Sabri Albana. He was born in 1937 in the Palestinian coastal city of Jaffa. His family was one of the wealthiest and most distinguished families in Palestine and owned, among other things, more than 6,000 acres of orange orchards, which were the major source of income for the family. When Sabri Albana was an 11-year-old schoolboy, the Jews seized all of his family's orchards and other lands, all of their houses, and everything else his family owned. And he and his family ended up living in a tent in a refugee camp in the Gaza Strip. Quite a shock for a quiet, introverted little boy. The shock led him to dedicate his life to evening the score, to gaining justice for his people, to striking back at the Jews who had stolen all of his family's property and driven them into a refugee camp. He built what was probably the most highly disciplined and ruthless fighting organization on the Palestinian side. He struck not only at Jews, but also at Palestinians who collaborated or compromised with the Jews. Whenever Abu Nidal's troops would strike, machine-gunning Israeli tourists at an airport or bombing some Jewish facility in another country, the politicians and the media here always would go into hysterics about Arab terrorism. I always cheered. Abu Nidal is not some crazed murderer who likes to kill people. He is a Palestinian patriot fighting for his people and for his country in the only way he can fight under the circumstances. He does not hate America's freedom, as George Bush and the media would have you believe. There is no reason for him to be an enemy of America except that we have made him an enemy by arming and financing the Jews who stole his family's orange groves and forced him into a refugee camp. Remember that whenever you buy an orange that came into America from Israel, one of those sweet Jaffa oranges that are so favored by New York Jews. That orange is stolen property. It belongs to Abu Nidal. It was stolen from him by the Jew who sold it to you. By the way, a good source of information on Abu Nidal is a report published for the U.S. government in September 1999 by the Library of Congress. It's titled, The Sociology and Psychology of Terrorism, Who Becomes a Terrorist and Why? It's available on the Internet now. Nearly everything that the average American thinks he knows about the Middle East, everything told to him by the government or the media about current events or history in Afghanistan, Iraq, Palestine, Israel, or about American involvement in that part of the world, is part of a tissue of lies spun by the Jews to serve their interests at the expense of ours. The lie told by Flame and published by U.S. News and World Report, and that magazine, incidentally, is owned by Jewish real estate speculator Mortimer Zuckerman, the lie that the real Palestinians are Jews and the Arabs claiming to be Palestinians are interlopers is typical. The lies told to the American people by the controlled media and the government and the schools certainly are not limited to lies about the Middle East, however. The same Flame ad in U.S. News and World Report that we've just discussed begins with a lie that has nothing to do with the Middle East. It's a lie that Americans have been told so often that most of them accept it unquestioningly as the truth. Even university-educated Americans who believe that they are sophisticated enough to distinguish Jewish propaganda lies from the truth. This is the way the Flame ad begins, and I quote, Joseph Goebbels, the infamous propaganda minister of the Nazis, had it right. Just tell people big lies often enough, and they will believe them. End of quote. The message there is clear. The Nazis advocated fooling the people by telling them big lies and repeating those big lies frequently, right? We've all been told that 1,000 times, haven't we? We learned it in school. We heard it on television. Half the politicians in Mr. Bush's government undoubtedly have warned us at one time or another about the Nazi big lie propaganda technique. Usually, however, the principal Nazi advocate of the big lie is named as Adolf Hitler rather than Joseph Goebbels. We've all heard about Hitler's big lie technique, and so we all should be grateful to the Jews for warning us about it, right? I mean, no matter what we think about Jews otherwise, we at least owe them for warning us about Nazi lies, don't we? You know, I used to believe that myself. But I was fortunate enough to know someone who told me that it wasn't so. This person told me that neither Hitler nor Goebbels had advocated the big lie technique for deceiving the public. He told me that the opposite was true, that in fact Hitler, far from advocating the use of the big lie, had warned his people that the Jews use this big lie technique and that the German people should be wary of it. Well, when I hear something like that, my tendency is to check it out for myself. I don't accept many things on faith. And when my friend told me that Hitler had neither invented nor advocated the big lie, after I had heard so many times in school and on TV that Hitler had done those things, at first I didn't believe him. I checked it out for myself, and that's what you should do. I got a copy of Hitler's book, Mein Kampf, from the library, and I read what Hitler wrote back in 1926 about propaganda and lying and about the Jews. You know, Mein Kampf is still in print today. If you can't find an English translation of the book in your local library, you can buy a copy from Amazon.com or from Barnes & Noble. Or better, you can buy a copy from the sponsors of this program, National Vanguard Books. They stock and sell the original German edition and two different English translations. Anyway, I'll read to you exactly what Hitler wrote about the big lie. I'll read from the Ralph Manheim translation that is currently published in this country by the Houghton Mifflin Company. In chapter 10 of the first volume of Mein Kampf, Hitler writes about the role of Jewish Marxist propaganda in bringing about the collapse of the German war effort during the First World War and then blaming that collapse on German General Erich Ludendorff. I quote, "It required the whole bottomless falsehood of the Jews and their Marxist fighting organization to lay the blame for the collapse on that very man who alone, with superhuman energy and willpower, tried to prevent the catastrophe he foresaw and save the nation from its time of deepest humiliation and disgrace. By branding Ludendorff as guilty for the loss of the World War, they took the weapon of moral right from the one dangerous accuser who could have risen against the traitors to the fatherland. In this, they proceeded on the sound principle that the magnitude of a lie always contains a certain factor of credibility, since the great masses of the people, in the very bottom of their hearts, tend to be corrupted rather than consciously and purposely evil, and that, therefore, in view of the primitive simplicity of their minds, they more easily fall victim to a big lie than to a little one, since they themselves lie in little things, but would be ashamed of lies that were too big. Such a falsehood will never enter their heads, and they will not be able to believe in the possibility of such monstrous effrontery and infamous misrepresentation in others. Yes, even when enlightened on the subject, they will long doubt and waver and continue to accept at least one of these causes as true. Therefore, something of even the most insolent lie will always remain and stick, a fact which all the great lie virtuosi and lying clubs in the world know only too well and also make the most treacherous use of. The foremost connoisseurs of this truth regarding the possibilities and the use of falsehood and slander have always been the Jews, for after all their whole existence is based on one single great lie, to wit, that they are a religious community while actually they are a race. And what a race! One of the greatest minds of humanity has nailed them forever as such in an eternally correct phrase of fundamental truth. He called them the great masters of the lie. And anyone who does not recognize this or does not want to believe it will never in this world be able to help the truth to victory." End of quote. Now I ask you, does that sound as if Hitler invented the big lie or was advocating its use? Or does it sound as if he were condemning this as a Jewish technique and warning his fellow Germans about it? What do you think? It's too bad he didn't warn us Americans too, because over here the Jews have used the very technique against which Hitler warned in 1926. To put the blame for this technique on Hitler himself. I guess that all it takes is enough chutzpah, as they proudly call it. And it certainly took chutzpah on the part of the Jews who wrote that flame ad accusing the Palestinians of being interlopers in Palestine, and furthermore accuses them of using the big lie technique when the Palestinians charge that it is the Jews, not they, who are the interlopers. The brazenness of the Jews really takes one's breath away. Anyway, I apologize for reading such a long excerpt from Mein Kampf, but it does give us just one more really clear-cut and unambiguous example of the way in which the Jews in the media and their collaborators in the government lie to us with the utmost brazenness and arrogance. Thanks for being with me again today.